On this episode of 115 Miles, both Haz and I have massive, massive announcements to make. You don't want to miss this. Two incredible announcements coming your way. Check it out now.
This is 115 Miles with Josh Connolly and Hassan Kaya. We hope you're sitting comfortably because this is about to get uncomfortable.
Did you see that dude who went, went all inclusive in Turkey for a month?
No.
Because he's living in Manchester.
Yeah.
And he worked out that to go and live all inclusive in Turkey, in a hotel in Turkey, was cheaper than his combined bills to live in Manchester. So when he combined his rent, electricity, council tax, before he had bought food and anything else,
yeah,
it was cheaper. It was 900 and something pound for the month to go and stay in the cheapest all-inclusive hotel in Turkey. So he sort of went viral for doing it. He just went and lived for a month in Turkey because it was cheaper.
If you're a single individual.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, because that he's obviously talking about his rent for a flat, isn't it? If you were, I don't know, two-parent family with two kids, you'd need a
I mean, look, the point is very well made, isn't it? Like, it's just fucking ridiculous.
Mate, do you know the dude that's like, I don't know if he's starting to come up a lot. If he's
rolling?
I don't know if he's starting to get, we'll just start. I don't know if he's starting to get famous or not. I'm just going to look up who he is now. Or if he's just now in my ecosystem online. But his name is Cat Williams. Do you know who that is?
No.
Can I just show you a picture?
I like the name.
Oh, shit. He talks a lot about, like, do you know who he is? Do you recognize him?
Let me see.
It was like, would have been mates with like Tupac and that back in the day.
Don't know him.
Right, mate. So he's like showing up a lot on my feed now. And I've just, what am I there in? I'm into an hour into his podcast with Joe Rogan. Mate, he is fucking, he's like right up my street, yeah, because he's like proper calling stuff out. Like, this doesn't make sense. Like, you know, like what people would call conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
But he's, some of the stuff that he says is just like straight to the point. So what I've listened to him on Joe Rogan so far, it's talking about, have you ever looked down the rabbit hole of the pyramids in ancient Greece and all that?
No.
In Egypt. Yeah.
Go on. No.
Like, well, like in how they're built and how none of the way that science pulls it all together really makes any sense.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to look that far to now realize that what we're told about them's wrong. Right. So then there's loads of other theories, but the theory that they've given just doesn't add up. Like the way that it's built, like the chambers and stuff in there, where the stone and that comes from. Like, it's almost impossible. And when you go down the rabbit hole of looking at most old spiritual literature talks about a flood. Science doesn't tell you that there was a flash flood, but most ancient scripture does. And there's lots of evidence of floods around these different tombs and all that that have been built around the world. And how could they build one in Mexico or Peru that's exactly the same as one in Egypt?
Yeah.
All that stuff. Anyway, they're talking about that, and like there's loads of rabbit holes that he goes down. But he calls stuff out really clearly. So one of the things he's talking about in America, you know, look, they're housing a lot of the immigrants in America.
Yeah.
When they come up, they're giving them housing.
Yeah.
And he's like, I have no problem. I was going to try and do his voice, but he says, like, I have no problem with housing immigrants, but it's a little bit harsh to do it right in front of the faces of the homeless people.
Yeah.
And you go, fuck, man, I've never thought of that.
Yeah.
Do you understand what he's saying by that?
What do you mean to do it in the face of the homeless people?
Why, we don't house homeless people.
I see. Yeah.
Because we can't afford it, or there's no accommodation, or whatever it is. Mm. So he's like, if we can house them, why can't we do it for the homeless people?
Yeah, but I can't stop thinking about what's up with the pyramids.
Well, let me tell you more about it, mate. Like, so the way that they're built, the stone that they've used,
yeah,
it's all like, and the way that they're archaeologically built, so they are like to a point where they are facing true north and all of that,
right,
would be almost impossible with the tools that we've got now.
Okay, so what are you saying?
I just went off on a tangent.
No, I know, but what like, were they built by aliens? Like,
there's loads of different theories. One of the theories is that they were built by aliens, right? Is that it's from another planet.
Right.
There's things like, even like down to the drill holes in there. And they're like, there's no way you could drill through.
Show me the drill hole again.
There's no way you could drill through that stone.
Yeah, it was like.
By hand. It's impossible.
Okay.
So another theory is that civilization was as far along as it is now and then was wiped out.
By the flash flood.
By a flood, yeah. Yeah, that's like one theory that has a lot of evidence.
My youngest keeps saying that some random percentage she's just made up, said that 78% of people think we're all living in a simulation.
Yeah, I've heard that before as well. Yeah. But this is the thing, yeah? Damian Marley or Ziggy Marley, one of the Marleys, in one of the lyrics of his song, says most of us believe stuff that we can't even remotely prove.
Yeah.
So that's the rabbit holes that I keep going down, mate. You have to believe that everything that you've been told by those in power who send us through 10 years of school and teach us everything very purposely, we all just believe it. We talked about it before, even on like, do you remember the ozone layer?
Yeah, I do.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you remember when your deodorant was putting a hole in the ozone layer?
Yeah.
And you should start wearing a roll-on?
CFCs.
What happened to the ozone layer, mate?
It healed itself.
Where's it gone?
It's healed itself.
Why don't we talk about it anymore?
It's a good point.
I see a comedian.
I remember seeing an article about a year ago saying the ozone layer had healed itself.
So that's it.
But how can that happen when we are in the midst of a climate
crisis that used to be called global warming?
Yeah. Oh yeah, what happened to global warming?
Well, it used to just be that Earth heats up and that's kind of always been the way. Think about how many of the things that you believe about the world, yeah?
Yeah.
And I know you do what most people do when I talk about this, which is get a bit like, oh, what does it matter? Most of the things
the reason I'm doing that is because you've basically been on a monologue for 10 minutes.
Most of the things that you believe about the world, yeah, you got nothing to back up the fact that you believe it.
Yeah, that's true.
Other than somebody told you.
It's true, yeah.
Anyway, mate, welcome. Go and listen to the Cat Williams podcast.
I will, just because I like the name Cat Williams as well.
The way he talks as well. And
is there a drawl?
A what?
A drawl.
What does that mean?
Just like... cool, sort of.
Yeah, mate. Yeah. And him and Joe Rogan are smoking weed on it. Yeah. So I'm about an hour in and they're just starting to get quite stoned. Yeah. And I've seen like clips of like 2 or 3 hours in and mate, he's mashed out of his face.
Okay.
Anyway, mate, we've wasted a good bit of time there.
You've wasted a good bit of time.
You were listening, mate. You kept asking me.
I did, I probed.
I was done. You was like, tell me more about the thingy.
Yeah, fair point. The pyramids, I'm curious about. Let's go into that again.
Mate, go down the rabbit hole.
Too busy.
It is incredible. You're not too busy.
I'll just be a sheep. It's much easier. Yeah. Life is easier as a sheep.
Anyway, mate, let's start with the check-in. How are you?
I'm all right, but I'm worried about the pyramids. No, I'm all right.
You might be an alien.
I think I am an alien. I'm doing very well. We're going to talk about some of it. Some of the reason why this episode. I'm not sleeping very well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just lately I've been waking up quite a lot in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I know I've got a lot on my plate, but I don't feel stressed out. No. I don't feel stressed out. I know I've got a layer of stress. But something I've been thinking about is I sometimes think my body doesn't let me deal with stress. Like
what
even
do you mean by that?
I think it blocks it. It blocks it. It keeps it contained. It doesn't let me feel what I need it to let me feel. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So you know I'm an avoider, right? I think my body... a mind naturally avoids stress. So as soon as something starts to come up, I just kick into survival mode. But that doesn't mean it's not there. It just means I'm not present to it.
Yeah.
So I feel like when I wake up, I know I've got stuff going through my mind, but I don't feel like anxious when I wake up the next morning. I'm just like, okay, well, I didn't sleep very well, so I move on. But that can't be healthy, right?
Yeah, I don't know, man. Do you get any physical ailments as a result of it? Any IBS type symptoms or anything like that?
No.
Backache, bellyache?
No, nothing that I can think of.
It's one of them, isn't it? Then what's the problem?
Something though that came up in a podcast I was listening to was, so the only area that I carry a bit of extra weight is around my midriff, right? Which is where visceral fat kind of builds up, right?
Yeah.
And all this time I'm thinking, oh, I've got to eat less bread and you know what I mean? I've got to do a bit more exercise or whatever. But this podcast I listened to, it was on that Rangan Chatterjee one, they said that the biggest contributor to it is stress.
What, to weight gain?
To like midriff, to your belly, right? So
I'm not fucking buying that, but
well,
carry on.
Well, I'm not saying that I went, okay, well, that's it, that must be it.
Yeah.
But what they're saying is your a contribution to your retention of fat is related to your stress. That I can believe.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not.
Is that because when you're stressed you eat more, or is it it's
what your body retains in order to stave itself off from threat. So it's the fight or flight thing.
Yeah.
But what made me think about that is like, I'm not really too worried about that. What I'm thinking is that's what made me start thinking, oh, maybe your body does retain stress, but just you're not aware of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's true.
100%. Like there's a lot of people that will say that a lot of like cancers and that are related to stress, don't they?
Yeah.
And like holding in stress. And I always say, not drinking alcohol reduces my chance of certain kinds of cancer, because of the ones that are associated with alcohol.
Yeah.
I wonder...
Your liver as well.
Yeah, I wonder how much that... So, like, I reduce risk on in one hand. I wonder how much I increase risk on the other hand by not having something that just releases my stress straight away. I'd be interested to know, because it's easy to just go, I don't drink, mate, so I don't do anything mind altering, so I'm proper healthy. But I am fucking so uptight and stressed all the time.
Yeah, walking around like a ball of stress. Yeah,
and what impact is that having on me? Yeah,
yeah. Because it's funny when you've talked on here about sometimes getting so anxious that like you don't know what to do with yourself in a way, right? I wonder if that's because you don't have the release mechanisms like other people do, and you've taken sugar out as well now.
Yeah,
which is another.
I don't know if I got released from sugar.
Well, not necessarily the sugar, but the emotional eating.
Yeah, like I think sugar helped to give me avoidance, whereas a drinking session gives you a blowout, doesn't it? Yeah. It gives you like a release, more of a release. And that's like, if I look at like my check-in, generally, I feel good, mate. You know, we're going to talk about stuff, but I've got lots of good stuff going on. I'm very excited. But like, I was in the office yesterday and we're just talking about it on the way in. But when I call it oversensed is the best way of describing it, right? When I get in the car on the way home, I would do anything in that moment to escape my body and the way that I feel. And like, I feel like I want like to tell people so they can support me, but I also want people to get the fuck away from me. Like, I want to be alone, but around people. I want to be moving and fidgety because I can't sit still, but I also want to just veg out. I want to go to sleep, but I don't want to close my eyes. It's horrendous, mate. Like, it is horrendous. And I did a big breathwork session last night, and that's one of the only things that settles me, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, as in, laid down and did it. But I also can't, I think, do a breath work, you know, at work. No, I can't do that. Like voice note somebody just so you're shit. And I just, like, no, I can't do that. And it, fuck. So the impact physically that that's having on me, it can only be detrimental. And I wonder how much, you know.
What's worse, that or what you might do to your body if you were overly consuming alcohol? Or just consuming.
Yeah. Like if I could just have 4 cans of beer, I didn't drink beer, but like if I could have like a couple of glasses of wine and just take the edge off, would that be more or less healthy for me?
How would you ever know that?
I don't know, man. I wonder if there's like...
There's probably is studies. There's probably, you could probably put 2 or 3 studies together, which is the impact of stress on your body. But what you would need to do is to understand that on teetotal people, right? Versus people who would... Like, it's hard to measure you against somebody who already has those other mechanisms.
Yeah, and you have to... There's so, again, like, because I've been sober nearly 12 years now, the length of sobriety would matter. First year, really, really hard. Years 2 to maybe 4 or 5, flying, sailing, barely any stress, like living off the fat of the land, how amazing sobriety is, and I'm not like that. Mm. 5 to 10 years, then things start creeping back in. Mm. I swear, like, since 10 years, it's almost like the stress is even more there. Mm.
Something that I've really started to explore and understand over the last few months is how important it is to challenge kind of long held beliefs about yourself. And like I've always sort of said to myself, I'm a busy mind. I have a busy mind. I've always got to be active. I'm always on the go. And so that always means I'm either reading something or listening to music. I just can't be still. But since I've been doing the running, it's become this like really lovely sort of habit that I'll go and do that. I'll come back, drink some water, sit down for a coffee, and then just sit and look out at the garden and like just be still. And at first it was like weird. I felt like I needed to put something into my ears or whatever. But actually now it's like a really, really, it's a really sort of powerful sort of day start for me now. Mm. And I think whatever you need to do to kind of calm the noise in your head, for you it was breathwork in the moment. Like people just need to try and figure out what that is, and they may have never discovered it. Like you need to be like open to the idea that you maybe never have discovered what you need. I only discovered stillness recently, and actually I think it has the most profound effect on what I need.
Do you think that stillness is enjoyable because it comes post run?
Yeah,
I think that's so true of like boys and men, and it might be true of other genders, I don't know. Yeah, but like I know from speaking with the men's work that I do particularly, like it's very, I think like most men, whether they know it or not, need to do something fairly regularly that makes them like get it out. Whether that's like running and then getting to your like, you know, pushing it until you get home, whether it's playing football and like going to war a little bit in that way. I feel like we're supposed to do that. Not, of course, not all men, and there will be some that aren't the same, but I feel like it's really common, man. Mm. Like, I guarantee you, if you're not doing any kind of movement or pushing yourself to a physical brink regularly, if you're not doing that and you're suffering with stuff, introducing it will change it considerably. I'm not saying it will heal it or that it's, but so you know what I mean?
If I reframe what you just said, I think everyone needs that, right? Everyone needs it. But I think men stand a lot more to gain from it because they don't talk, they hold it in, they don't have sort of communities in the same way. And so that's why it probably feels like men need it more.
So you think it's more that the societal...
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not so sure, man.
You think it's a physiological thing?
If I was to say what I truly believed, I would say it was a cocktail of both.
Yeah.
I would say it was a cocktail of both.
Yeah.
But I know when I've just played football, full session of football.
Yeah.
Straight after that, I'm way less, way, like the chances of me flipping out at the kids, getting angry with the kids, for example, which is a good indicator of my stress.
Yeah.
Is just.
But I think that's true of everyone. That's the thing I'm sort of saying. I think everyone that needs that, and I'm not just trying to be all politically.
No, I know you're not. Yeah, I know you're not. And by the way, I'm not fully behind what I'm saying.
No, I think everyone that's pushed themselves, exerted themselves, worked through stuff, whatever your stress, whatever your challenge is, you're going to be better on the other side of it. You've challenged yourself, you've pushed yourself, you've shown that your mind is, the body can do whatever the mind allows it to do. And you're just I'm always in a much better space when I've done that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yes.
So maybe it is the same for, maybe it is the same for all genders. But what I do know to be true is that from the men's spaces.
Yeah.
So like, and I operate in a lot of mixed spaces.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which are probably, my mixed spaces are probably more women than men.
Yeah.
But then I operate once a month, particularly in
Uncommon Man.
Yeah. In Uncommon Man, in a men's space.
Yeah.
You
see it.
The topic of conversation in the men's space, when they're talking about solutions or things that really work for them, pushing themselves to the limit comes up way more there than it does in the women's. Now, there could, like you say, be lots of different reasons for that, right? And it could be that men feel like they're supposed to say, I'm going to punch a fucking punch bag or something. You know, the societal pressures to believe that go into war in some way. But I feel like I need to go to war a little bit once a week. Mm. And it just gets rid of all of that. It's like a static energy, you know, that it just goes and then I'm all right.
One last thing on this. Our good friend, our joint good friend, Mark, who we know listens to this, he's a runner. And I was asking him a question around running. Like, does running give you energy or do you need energy to run? And he's a very, very accomplished runner. And he said something to me that's really sort of stuck with me. He goes, I run best when my head is clear and my heart is full.
Mm.
I think there's something really powerful in that. I think that's what, if you can get to a place where actually you can have that equilibrium, you can like really enjoy life, right? And that might be like physical exertion. It may be just pushing yourself into whatever capacity. But I think that's what I don't need that's what I'm looking for. I'm genuinely looking for what he's just mentioned there.
And I think what he's talking about is when you're fully in your body.
Yeah.
You know, like when you get to a certain stage on that running and you're just that dum, 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 and you're just going and there's nothing else but one foot in front of the
meditation.
Other.
Meditation.
You're present. That's like, I think that's what we're all shooting for, isn't it, in life. Some, you know, is to get a version of that.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, man. Talking about it makes me want to run. Yeah. I hate running.
Yeah. No, I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it.
Okay, mate. Well, look, let's get to the point now where we both got a couple of announcements to make. Yours is fresher than mine. So let's start with you. Why not I just hand you the floor?
Yeah. Well, thank you.
And you make your big announcement, mate.
Well, at the time of publishing this episode, we will have come out of stealth mode on our secret project that we've been working on for well over a year. We'll be launching our new platform for managers called Tiller, and it's a self-care and personal development platform. So, you know, we'll get into it hopefully on the discussion, but something I'm really passionate about is helping managers be their best self in the world. And traditional learning for managers is just about developing skills, how to delegate, how to give feedback. But actually, being a manager is so much more complex and it has so much greater ramifications if they don't feel competent and confident and comfortable being a manager. It has an impact on them personally, it has an impact on their teams, but also you take that stuff home. And then it has impact on your circle and your family. So what we're trying to do is cover many more bases than just developing skills, personal growth, well-being. We're normally you'd have to go to other sources. We're pulling that all into one. So I'm like hyper excited. So we come out of stealth mode, which means we've been building a secret. We're not building a secret anymore. And then we're going to be launching in May. So very excited.
So it's from May that people can sign up to it.
Yeah, you can sign up before, but they'll be able to access it from May.
And the platform is specifically for managers?
It's only for managers, yeah.
Okay.
Like I think you can get, you know, there are loads of like learning platforms, right? LinkedIn, Udemy and all that. But you kind of have to put a lot of effort in to find the gold. But we wanted to just make it really easy, very intentional, very deliberate for managers. Like one of our sort of pillars is separate the signal from the noise. And so we just want to give them exactly what they need when they need it with whatever they need so that they can just get going.
Do you have set pillars then? Have you said one of our pillars or do you just mean that in a general way?
We have set pillars, yeah. The other ones are change yourself to change the world. So the idea that you can change the world if you begin with yourself first. So the notion of put your own oxygen mask on first. And another one I'd like to share is to always put our learner first. Mm-hmm. So in all of our design, we kind of put empathy and compassion into like what it's like to be a manager, and we design that way versus like, oh, here's something that we want you to buy. We're trying to create something for all kinds of managers with all different kinds of learning styles. What makes us different, I think, is there's no one size fits all. So sometimes, so the platform basically, you've got courses, you'll recognize yourself as one of the instructors on there. We're gonna have like reels and shorts, so just to kind of mimic how we learn when we're not at work, you know, like social media. We've got scripts for like meetings, so when you're short of time, you've got 2 minutes, you know you need to have a difficult conversation, there's a script that you can just kind of adopt for yourself and walk through that meeting. We've got breathworks and meditations. And then a massive part of it is a nurturing and thriving community, which when put together is a really unique composition and doesn't exist in the world.
Mm. So what sort of manager's gonna wanna use it?
It really depends on, it's gonna sound like I'm sitting on the fence, but every single manager can benefit from it. So our current product that we have in market at the moment is called Maverick Managers Toolkit. And that's really for early stage managers, right? It's to teach them the foundational skills. Tiller is for every manager.
Mm.
It's particularly gonna help you if you have just picked it up and you're trying to figure out your role. It can help you accelerate in your pathway, but it can also just provide you some of the tools, the know-how, the skills that you'll need. But it will also be really, really helpful if you're struggling a bit as a manager, right? And if you're finding the job overwhelming, if you're starting to have your performance managed by your company because you're not doing the job of manager very well, this is going to be the sort of the sidekick that you need. Mm. On that point, one of the reasons, you know, me and the team are so passionate about this is because managers are completely unsupported and untrained. 82% of managers are known as accidental. I think I've talked about it on this podcast before. That means they've had no formal training. They've been, an example is they are probably good at a craft or a skill, yeah? And then they're so good at it, somebody says, oh, well, we're gonna promote you. We're gonna give you a little bit more money, a lot more responsibility, and no training. And then what happens is, people stop remembering that Josh is good at resilience and they go, well, Josh isn't managing his team properly. But they don't go, oh, we didn't provide the support to Josh. And then what happens is it's a negative spiral because Josh isn't doing his job. And so he's starting to get worried and anxious and he's starting to overwork and he doesn't know how to get out of it. And then everyone's kind of miserable as a result. And we want to kind of change the narrative. We want to make it a much more content experience for the manager to give them the tools and resources they need. That means that their teams will enjoy life more. They'll be more productive, they'll get more done, there'll be better harmony. And then outside of work, you're happier because you're not worrying about this stuff quite in the same way that you used to before. And the thing about this is it's always there whenever you need it. That's the most important thing. It's like, you know, with learning, you can go on a course and you can, you know, learn lots of brilliant stuff. But unless you're putting that into effect within 48 hours, it's called the Ebbinghaus effect, you start to lose it. But having something at your side whenever you need it, I think is going to give people comfort as they go through their roles.
So will I be able to, if I'm a manager and something's gone down, some shit's gone down and I feel ill-equipped to be able to do it, am I going to be able to go on there and like find something relevant that might support me in that moment?
Yeah, 100%. So we've got three major categories. We've got well-being, we've got personal growth, and skills. And within those three broad buckets, we've got subcategories. And so, you know, we've got a vast array of content that's going to be covered. And the way that we do that is we find experts in the world who are, you know, absolute champions of what they do. We go into partnership with them. We bring their content onto our platform. So the closest thing that, you know, that might represent us in the sort of, in the entertainment space is like, or learning it slash entertainment, it's called edutainment, is Masterclass, right? So right. If you're familiar with Masterclass, they'll find experts that most of us will know in culture, like Steph Curry, basketball, Gordon Ramsay. They'll film them, you know, how to do that craft, and then they'll get it out to their audience. And that's a similar model that we're adopting.
Right. So any, like, any issue that I face, is there like a search bar I can go in?
Yeah. So it's a, you know, we spent a lot of time building this platform. We've been working with a brilliant partner who's built us, you know, they're specialists in education. So you've got, you've got search functionality. You can filter by type, by length of time that you have. You can save stuff. So, you know, if you're having a quick browse, but you can't get into it now, you can come back to it. And there's like a lot more stuff down in kind of in the product roadmap where we're going to sort of...
What was the idea born out of? How have you landed at building this? Like, I'm thinking personally here, not for a second thinking about the consumer of this. What motivated you to do this?
So when you say like not the consumer, it is intrinsically linked to why I wanted to do it, right? I've always wanted to help people be their best self in the world. So whether that's in my former life when I was a manager myself, I always tried to lead from the front. I always tried to help people be their best self. I challenged them, but also kind of nurtured them. As I've built my sort of consulting business and we operated more at the senior executive end, we've tried to do that. And what I felt for me when we were sort of 6 or 7 years deep into that was I felt like we were only like covering like a small percentage of the kind of the population that we wanted to look after, because we were only focusing on executive people. But actually, I think what started to pique my curiosity was, well, how bad is this situation, from the roots up, right? And actually, it's huge, as I've discussed with you just now. So what I wanted to do was kind of, you know, create more access to these things that are often just for the privileged at the top of a pyramid. We're talking about pyramids again. And that was it. And, you know, ultimately, I care massively, and as does the team, on making a difference. We're not doing this just to make money, genuinely. We're doing this because we know that people are struggling. It's an epidemic. Only 17% of managers feel energized and motivated at work, right? 90% of managers in a recent survey by CultureAmp, who are like engagement specialists, 90% of managers feel unsupported. They want more training. They want more support. That's why we're doing it.
Yeah. I've lost my trailer for completely.
I put you to sleep. Now look,
no,
look.
You didn't. I had a question and then I've lost it thinking about what you were saying.
I'll just say one more thing, actually.
Go on.
It's not just about the platform. Like, I know we've talked about it. For me, a huge part is community, right? Mm. So we're building a peer-to-peer community. We're going to be in the community. And I think that's a huge part because, you know, like you can probably find what you need to find if you put a lot of effort into Google or whatever, right? Mm. But what really empowers you, what really gives you confidence, what really gives you comfort is being around other people that are kind of going through the journey. Somebody might give a bit of advice that isn't sitting on our platform, that isn't on one of our courses, that isn't in one of our scripts. But actually, that's what you need to hear in the moment. That's the little bit of, oh, you've been there before and that really works for me. And then for them to go, you know, to be able to have a platform to have a discussion, that's really, really important to me.
That's actually where I was going with it. You reminded me, not to keep bringing it back to pyramids, but if you look at the managers as being in the middle of that, I actually think to a lot of organizations that I've worked with, even like smaller ones, but even some of the bigger ones, I'm often dealing with a manager of some sort, right? Who's getting me in to support their team or whatever, yeah? So they're, and then they have to go and report to people above them. They're often like the most unsupported.
Unsung heroes.
Because the people that are like below them are supported by them. They go to them for support. And then their job is to support them, right? So it's very difficult to them to go to above and say, I need support in supporting them because, well, that's your job. You're the manager. Mm. So I often hear when I'm interacting with them, they often come across as quite lonely.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? As quite lonely because, you know, they're getting me in, not for them. I'm coming in for their team. Sometimes you feel like you want to say, how are you doing? Like, what is there for you? And It doesn't really exist, does it? And some of the bigger organizations that I've worked with, I feel like some of those managers, you can see the passion for what they started off, for what they started the job in, is sort of draining out of them. Mm. Do you think a lot of them, by the way, move companies as a result of that? Because what I see is that they lose their passion and then they lose their passion and then they move because they think they need something to re-stir some passion and energy in them. Like they're starting again, but going to another company gives that.
Yeah.
Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think people do move, but they take their situation with them.
Yeah.
Because actually they haven't been given the support that they needed to be given. It is extremely lonely. And I do think that they are disproportionately unsupported. And the thing about managers is it starts when you get your first supervisory promotion and just it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the challenge within the workforce and therefore society is that you then have incompetent people in important leadership positions.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to tackle.
Yeah.
So when I say that, like, there's a ripple effect in society, you know, not like you've got people who are feeling stressed and burnt out. They're spending more and more time at work, right? So there's your personal experience of work. There's the experience of others around you within the workplace. And that just kind of, it has a vicious cycle effect. Is it vicious circle or vicious cycle? Anyway,
vicious cycle, yeah.
It has that effect because then you're less productive. Therefore, you know, people are being let go because companies aren't performing well enough. And then you have more people in unemployment and then blah, 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 blah. So actually, I can't say that I'm going to save everything that isn't working in the world, but I can focus on work because that's what I've been doing
for the
last 20 plus years.
Yeah.
That's it.
And I feel like you'll stop them in addiction, in recovery spaces, they call it a geographical, right? Which is I'm going to move somewhere else because that'll solve all of my problems. I'll get a new lease of life. And they might get it for a little while in that new job, but then they realize they're just in the same position again. They're stuck in that middle space as a manager, feeling lonely with no support.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing I'll say, because I want to come on to you, is I think why this matters now is because life is getting harder for people, particularly for working class, middle class, like it's a struggle. And if you feel confident and if you feel like you have some autonomy and some empowerment to look after yourself, to develop your skills, to develop your well-being, to grow yourself, you'll see that there's more possible for you. So this isn't really just about supporting managers. I think it's about supporting anyone that wants a place where they can kind of congregate with a community and learn and grow and develop at the same time as well.
Mm.
And I think, again, just, you know, what makes us different is we're pulling in well-being, we're pulling in personal growth, and we're pulling in skills development together, one platform, one experience, one central resource. I don't think that exists anywhere.
That's banging, mate. That's a bit of a mic drop moment there as well, isn't it? Well, what we do is quite similar, isn't it, in many ways when you break it down?
Yeah.
It's just in different spaces, isn't it?
Yeah.
Community and like giving people autonomy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why we mostly, we don't mostly agree on here, but mostly outside of here we agree, right? But yeah, I think so, absolutely. Yeah. Community is something we've both talked about as being the solution, I think, to like, or the beginnings of a solution to like what we face as a society.
Most things, man. Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, Tiller comes out of Secret Works tomorrow, launches in May, TYLLR.co.
I've been putting an E in it.
Well, you've been doing it wrong.
Story of my life, that is, putting an E in something that's...
Okay. I missed it. I was getting into journalist mode. All right, mate. So, thank you for giving me some space.
That's right, mate. You deserve it.
Oh, thank you, sir. It's them, not you.
Yeah.
Firstly, what is it?
You should be a journalist.
I know.
Yeah, it's them, not you. How to break free from toxic parenting and reclaim your story is my newly published book that's now out for pre-order. I've announced it last week. I announced it on the 7th of March, and it will be available on the 11th of July.
So excited, man. So excited.
Yeah, man.
One of my most successful posts on LinkedIn has been a post about your book. So what's it about?
Look, it's to support anybody really that's grown up in any kind of dysfunction and feels like there's a level of healing that they need to do. And rather than it being about like focusing on how you navigate the situation, although there are, you know, it does give you support in that, it's largely about regaining what you've lost as a result of that dysfunction. It's about reclaiming your power, coming back to yourself so that you can feel empowered to make the decisions that are right for you, and you can get some freedom back in your life, get some autonomy back in your life.
So I just want to ask you about dysfunction, because I think, you know, many of our listeners, they'll get it straight away. They've probably pre-ordered. Others won't get it because they've got a view that their family dynamic is completely functional.
Mm.
Can you say a bit more about dysfunction?
Look, I think that there's no such thing as a functional family. I think it's varying levels of dysfunction. That's my opinion. I think a lot of people grow up and get to adulthood and they've done pretty well. But I think that it's a huge red flag for me when somebody thinks that they've had the perfect upbringing. You know what I mean? When they've had the perfect upbringing. And I think that my belief is that Western culture sort of breeds and teaches dysfunction. We're built around emotional avoidance. Even I think when you look at the mental health conversation in general, it's all about new ways to rationalize the shit out of the ways that you feel so that you don't have to feel them. So like when I'm talking about dysfunction, I'm talking about the inability to be able to support you as a child into becoming who you are.
Yeah.
And I think it's really difficult to do that in today's world.
Yeah. The reason I asked the question is because I think I agree with you. I think that every family dynamic and every sort of dynamic where there's sort of, you know, people involved, there's a level of dysfunction. There's no perfect space. And there may be some people that are going to just vehemently disagree with us. Say, look, I look at my upbringing and everything was perfect. But as I've started to do more self-discovery, I started to look back at my experience of childhood, and I would say that overall, I would still have the belief that I had a really great childhood and upbringing. But I'm also more tuned into things as a parent than I was before I was one. But the acceleration has come through self-discovery and like learning. I'm interested in like, what about the person who's like, no, I had a perfect life. You know, we grew up in a sort of a perfect family environment, good education, I've got a job, I've got my own family, we get together. Like, what about that person?
Well, look, if you feel all right, then you feel all right. Like, crack on, like, go live the life that you've got, right? I do think that's important. I'm not here to say if your life's really good, sooner or later you're going to realise it's not. But I think if you've got any kind of struggle in your life, if there's anything in your life that you know that deep down you're struggling with and you don't know where it comes from, then I think there's some exploration to do.
Yeah.
And I think like also, like we're taught stuff like never talk about your family outside the home. Yeah, that's dysfunctional. That's wrong. Like I actually will actively say to my kids, if I'm doing anything that makes you feel uncomfortable, yeah, talk to somebody outside the house. Talk to one of your teachers about it. If I'm doing something that you're not sure about and you don't want to come to me about it and you're worried about coming to your mum about it, like talk to granddad about it or nan about it. And if that's hard, then talk to your teachers about it. Yeah, talk to somebody about it, right? Talk to anybody. It's highly dysfunctional to say to a child, what happens in this house stays in this house and you shouldn't be talking to anyone outside of it.
Mm.
The only reason you would say that is because you're terrified of what people might think of you if they hear about some of your stuff.
Mm.
And so you have to do a level of work on yourself, I believe, to be more comfortable with that.
Mm.
Like to be like okay with like knowing that we're all messy individuals, yeah? We all mess up. There's shit that my kids will have to heal from in their childhood. And, you know, there's a saying that says, give your children a childhood that they don't need to heal from. I'm like, fucking good luck with that.
Mm.
Good luck with that, man. Like, I'm more of the opinion, be a safe space for your kids to come to when they reach adulthood and they need to do a bit of work on themselves. And they need to come to you. I want my kids to be able to come to me and say, you know what, Dad? You were fucking emotionally avoidant a lot when I was a kid. And I can feel my emotion saying it because I'm talking like, you know, I'm not pointing the fingers when I talk about stuff, yeah? I want my kids to feel that they can come to me when they're adult and say, you know what, Dad, you were emotionally avoidant when I was a kid and it fucking hurt me.
Mm.
And I went through some shit and you weren't there for me.
Yeah.
And I need to be able to go, shit, man, I don't like that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't good enough, but it wasn't good enough. And how can we talk about it? Yeah. How can we explore it? What impacts it had on you?
Yeah.
How can I support you knowing that? That's where I want to help people to get to, because that's what's needed. Everybody that I work with, and I've worked with thousands of people, yeah, and I don't say that with any arrogance, but I've listened to thousands of people who are struggling in their adulthood emotionally. And one thing that could change their life so dramatically is to have a parent that's willing to sit down, listen, and hear about all of their fuck-ups, see it, hear their child, and acknowledge it and validate what they're feeling. That would change so many people that I work with's life, but most people haven't got the ability to do it. And one of the reasons they haven't, by the way, is because, like, at my core, I don't think I'm a bad person. But I know that I sometimes do bad things. I talked earlier about how I want to escape my body a lot. When I do, sometimes I mess up. Sometimes I'm not there for my kids in the way that I want to. It doesn't mean I'm a bad person, but I'm a messy human being, like I think we all are. And as a result of that, that's going to impact my kids, man. So like, I think that we got to get much better as a culture at being open to that. And that's a big thing for me with the book, man.
Amazing. I mean, I think one of the things I've learned in spending time with you over the last few years is to not think you can be a perfect parent, because you can't control the experience. It's not just parent, actually, sibling, son, you know, like, you can't be the perfect to anyone because you can't control the other person's experience of you.
Yeah.
Like, you can influence it, but like, so when I think, oh, okay, here's what I would have done differently in my situation growing up. And so people often say, be the parent you wish you had when you were growing up. You've talked to me about that, right? But there's going to be other ways that, like you've just said, that we're not doing what our kids are looking for us to do. And at some point when they come down the line, they're going to have the same experiences, or not the same, they're going to have their own experiences of us as their parents.
But, and I also say, that's another saying that I sort of throw out of the water. Don't be the parent that you needed when you were a kid.
Yeah.
Try and be the parent your kid needs now.
Yeah.
Don't parent them from the pace of lack that you had in your childhood.
Yeah.
But also, like, it's very easy to be knowledgeable, compassionate, wise, all of them things when I'm sat here on a podcast, or if I'm doing a workshop, or I'm supporting somebody else. But come and see me in my home when one of my kids is like behaving in a way that I struggle with. I struggle, man. And I react so poorly sometimes as a parent. I react so poorly, way, way, way more poorly than I ever would react with you.
Yeah.
That's awful when you say it out loud.
Yeah.
But it's the reality, because our wounding, our trauma, it plays out in our relationships, in our really meaningful family relationships, the family dynamics.
What I'm hearing here is that you're not demonizing parents. You're humanizing a situation and experiences. Is that fair? Like,
I'm humanizing that we all sit somewhere on the scale. Now, it's important to say, a lot of the audience that I speak to are people who have got parents that sit right at the toxic end. And people will say to me, you know, nobody's toxic, it's just toxic behaviors. And I'm like, I fucking don't know, man. If you show up as toxic all of the time, and you never self-reflect, you never look at yourself, you never go to bed at night wishing that you were different and trying better the next day, and you might fuck up again, but then you keep trying. Yeah. Like, there are people who are just toxic all of the time, and I'm happy to call them toxic people.
Yeah.
And if that's your parent, it's a horrendous place to be in.
Yeah.
And that's really difficult. And in some ways, I probably am pointing at them.
Yeah.
And we all sit somewhere on that scale. And make no mistake about it, like, I talk about, one of the reasons I can talk so openly about toxic parents or narcissistic parents is because I've done so much work on myself. I see traits in myself. I recognize my own toxic traits, my own narcissistic traits. I know when I'm struggling emotionally, my tendency is to become a little bit narcissistic. I start thinking of myself and fuck, how do I get myself out of this one? That's like a narcissistic tendency. I think it's important to understand that. I think that's in everyone, by the way. I think it's in everybody. I think it's part of human nature. But there's a difference. There's a difference when you get to the top end of that scale, that people are just like it all of the time, never self-reflect, and their whole world and universe evolves around them. And imagine that's your parent, man. Imagine that's your parent. Fucking awful.
So I would love to have like a whole hour on this, because maybe when it comes out in July, we'll dig into it again in a bit more detail. But like, we've talked about a book for as long as we knew a book was going to come out. You were going to write one at one point. Why this book? Why now?
Look, I didn't want to write a memoir. I didn't want to write another memoir. When I was ready to write a book, it was going to be where I felt like I could give something to people that could really have an impact on them. I didn't want to write a book because it's fucking a good business move. Yeah. And people told me that all of the time when I first started in the corporate world, you should write a book. Mm. It gives you credibility and all that. I didn't want to do it for them reasons. I wanted to do it because I believed I had something that could help people. And having ran in a U now, we're about to launch the ninth. Well, we've launched the ninth one, ready to start. I know that I have a pathway for people that can really be life-changing to bring them back to themselves. And that's why I wrote the book now.
Amazing. Yeah. What kind of sets your book out from other people that are sort of talking about toxic relationships? What's different about your book?
The book is almost like a workbook, yeah? The book is going to take you on a journey. It's not like just reading it and going, wow, yeah, man, I've learned a lot. The book's going to take you on a journey. Each chapter finishes with a QR code that takes you to a full breathwork session. So there's 10 chapters.
I've not seen that. I've not seen something like that before. Like, I know there's sort of further resources, but this really, it takes you from a reading into an experience.
Yeah, yeah. So at the end of every chapter, you're going to have learned all of the stuff about that part of the journey. Then you're going to scan a QR code. It's going to take you to a breathwork that's going to get you to do all of the body work. It's going to have a visualization at the end of the breathwork, complete with scream and everything, that's really going to complete the cycle. So you're not just doing this academically and rationally in your head. You're going to go to a breath work at the end, and you're going to do the somatic work as well. And like I say, there's 10 chapters. Every chapter's got a QR code at the end. That's 10 breath work for emotional releases, man. Like, I don't care if you think you've grown up in perfect functional family environment, buy the book for 10 breath works, mate.
Yeah.
It's going to be banging.
And what do you like? What do you hope for with this book being released? What's your hope? What's your hope for society? What's your hope for people that are reading it? What are they going to take from it?
Firstly, validation, yeah, because it's a taboo subject. Yeah, it's like the
validation for them, self-validation.
Self-validation for people that you're not crazy. Yeah, you're not going mental, right? Mm-hmm. You did grow up in some difficult stuff, and it has been really, really hard for you. And also, here's a journey that you can go on so you can come back to yourself. You can be a cycle breaker. You don't have to pass this on to your kids, you know, in a full way. You get to be the change, and you get to start to create that change, because it will validate and then give you the tools to create meaningful change.
And is this only useful for parents, like people that have kids, or is this...
It's useful for anyone that has a parent.
Yeah, which is...
Everyone. Yeah, parent or caregiver. Yeah, everyone, man.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, parent or caregiver.
And last thing, just for me to finish on saying this, it's out for pre-order now. What a lot of people don't know about pre-ordering is they think that if you pre-order now, that you pay for it now. If you pre-order the book now, you won't pay until they send you the book. It comes out on the 11th of July. They'll probably send it on the 9th. So the payment will come out of your bank on the 9th. The more people that pre-order it, the more that price will go down if you buy it from Amazon. And so when that money comes out of your bank, Amazon give you a price point guarantee, and you'll pay whatever the book is at that moment. So if it comes down in price, you'll pay less for it when they take the money out of your bank.
So just to be abundantly clear, pre-ordering means you don't pay now, but you lock it in at a price, and it helps the price to come down, and then you get it at that lowest price.
Then you
price
get it at that price, yeah. And it's the best way that you can support me, yeah. Because pre-sales are massive in terms of what they'll do with the book and the amount of people that we can get it in front of and what countries it comes out in and stuff like that. So it's really important. It's the best way you can support anything that I'm doing now is to go and pre-order the book.
And how can they find out more, Josh?
Go to my website, mate.
Yeah, which is...
It's all on there, joshconnolly.co.uk.
Yeah, brilliant. Mate, I'm so excited.
Two big launches, mate.
Yeah.
A great year ahead, and I'm looking forward to it. Cheers, mate.
Ciao.
Thanks again for listening to 115 Miles with Josh Connolly and Hassan Kai.